Hi, I'm Simon Jones, and this is the Writer Centre Knowledge podcast from Dragon Hall. Today we've got an interview with Lea Tun, a writer and translator from Myanmar who spent 18 years in prison, 14 of them on death row. He was here with writer and editor Lucas Stewart to talk about Hidden Words, Hidden Worlds, an anthology of short stories from the region. The original version featured 28 short stories in 12 languages and 11 different scripts, which gives you an idea of the uniqueness of Myanmar's literature scene. Lea and Lucas discuss the challenges of writing in ethnic languages on computers that don't have proper input and font support, and how writers can navigate the complexities of censorship in an evolving cultural and political climate. We're in the thick of building work at the moment as Dragon Hall is transformed into the National Centre for Writing, so please do forgive the sounds of construction that you might hear in the background of this podcast. I'll now hand you over to Kate Griffin, Associate Programme Director here at Writers' Centre Norwich.
Hello, my name's Kate Griffin and I'm Associate Programme Director at Writers' Centre Norwich. This afternoon, I'm in conversation with the Burmese writer and translator Lea Tun and the writer and editor Lucas Stewart. They're both in Norwich to launch Hidden Words, Hidden Worlds. This anthology is the culmination of a five-year literature programme in Myanmar, which aims to give voice to writers from the ethnic states. Lucas, could you tell us how this anthology came about and what its significance is in the history of literature in Myanmar?
Thank you. It came about due to the transition. The British Council, which directed the project, was able to take advantage of the loosening of laws and 50 years of political, economical isolation, 50 years of censorship. We were able to access areas that had never been accessed before, able to access literatures that had never been accessed before. And I guess really that is the startling quality of the anthology and why it's so important, is because they are representing ethnic language literature for the first time, not just within the West or the UK, but the first time in Myanmar as well, the first time these languages have ever been written in a fiction form, especially in the short story form.
The overarching theme of the anthology is place and time. The stories give an introduction to life in Myanmar from urban Yangon to rural villages, and we also travel in time from the colonial era through the military regime to the present day. In your introduction, you mentioned that in Myanmar, the teaching and writing of ethnic languages and literature was discouraged or even criminalised. What's the situation now?
I guess in a single word, it is better, but it's not good. It's very common for directives to come from the union government, from the central government, that teaching ethnic languages and literatures is now possible in schools from grade up to grade three, but it's still not part of the curriculum. It's still an extracurricular activity, so obviously many students are unwilling to attend these classes, having already been in school for however many hours. The government has said they will provide a salary for teachers who teach these languages and literatures, but it's a dollar a day, so it's poverty wages. And quite often the money doesn't come from the central government to the state government. There's also a problem with books. Books have been promised. For example, the Shan Culture Literary Association, which is an ethnic cultural group, which is spearheading the design of syllabus for ethnic literature in Shan State. They were promised money for books. The money didn't come. They've been raising funds through the communities to do this themselves. When the books do come, they've often been translated from Burmese into the ethnic languages, so it's not always the best for especially young students. There's also been a bit of blowback as well from the local level, just because the politics at the top has changed with Daw Aung San Suu Kyi and the NLD governments. The GAD, the General Administrative Department, which effectively runs the administration at the tract and ward level, that hasn't changed. So, for example, there was an article in one of the ethnic language newspapers about a month ago, I think it was in Karen State, where Karen language and literature teachers were being moved by headmasters to schools where there were no Karen students, thereby making sure that the Karen students didn't have a teacher to be able to teach them. So, I mean, there are still lots of issues, but yes, it's certainly better than it was 5 years ago when you couldn't learn in the school premises and you couldn't really print or publish in an ethnic language.
What are the barriers to writing and publishing in the ethnic languages, or writing from the ethnic states?
Oh, so many. Yeah, there's still quite a few. I mean, there's sort of the general issues that I guess all countries in developing developing world house. There's lack of bookshops. There's no bookshops in the ethnic states, really. There's it's expensive to send the books from the power centres, the urban centres in Yangon and Mandalay, up to the ethnic regions. The other problem is a generational problem regarding the ability to write in an ethnic language using a particular font on the laptop. Computers still aren't being used in schools. A lot of people don't know how to use a computer. People can write in their script using a pen and paper, but they don't know the complications using the keyboard. And there are a whole raft of other issues as well. I mean, for example, the EPUB market has not hit Myanmar yet. You can get PDF downloads, but there's no access to EPUBs, which would make it a lot easier to get around the logistic issues.
Mm. How many languages do you have in the anthology?
In the original Myanmar...
Can you tell me what they are?
In the original Myanmar edition, there were 28 short stories in 21 languages. No, that's a lie. There was 28 short stories, 21 in Burmese translation. They were in 12 languages and 11 different scripts. In the English anthology, we've picked 8 languages, so Burmese and then 7 ethnic languages, which are Mon, Rakhine, Shanji from Shan State, Sagor Karen from Karen State, Kaya or Kayali, Lai Hakka from Chin State, and Jingpo from Kachin State.
And can you tell us a little about the process of bringing these stories into English? You mentioned the Burmese anthology and then the English anthology.
I guess the project itself was multiple components. We started with a TOT training workshop in Yangon for writers such as Lei Artun, in order to basically instruct how to teach how to write short stories. These writers were then sent up to the ethnic states, and we did short story construction workshops for local community members in partnership with a local ethnic culture and literature association. A local writer would partner with a Burmese writer. Those writers were almost all exclusively non-fiction writers, because fiction writers are very far and few between in the ethnic states. We spent about a year collecting the stories, selecting, translating, editing, proofreading, which was it was a struggle for the Myanmar edition, simply because of the sheer number of languages and scripts that we were dealing with, and trying to find people who were able to edit and draft those stories on a computer for us with multiple proofreaders. For the English edition, we partnered with the Writer Centre Norwich and the Select Centre in Singapore to hold a literary translation workshop. Graduates from those workshops were selected by Alfred Birnbaum, my co-editor on this anthology. 5 of them were then sent up to the ethnic states to work with the original ethnic writers. Because we were dealing with a bridge translation, for example, from Jingpo to Burmese and then Burmese to English, it was important that the translators were able to meet with the writers and get a clear and as true a version as possible. Once we got the English versions, we went through multiple drafts, another year of drafting, editing, and Alfred Birnbaum, who speaks, reads and writes excellent Burmese, he was able to polish the stories off, and we've managed to finally, after 5 years, publish the English anthology this month.
Congratulations. And then, how's the anthology been received, both in Myanmar and in the UK?
UK, it's still quite early. It's only been out for about a week. This is the third launch now, after Asia House in London and Aston University with a Writer Centre, writing West Midlands in Birmingham. And it was a lot of attention and a lot of interest. In Myanmar, the multilingual anthology was incredibly popular. There was a lot of interest, especially from where we launched it in Yangon. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of interest. We had about 280 at the book launch, which I think is probably the biggest book launch that I know of or have heard of in Myanmar, which shows the interest. And I think there was a lot of pride in the ethnic groups that, you know, their stories were now being read, and not just within the ethnic states, but also you know, we're within the power centers and now also in the West.
Thanks, Lucas. I'll turn now to Lea Tun. Lea, you've got two stories in this anthology, one that you've written and one that you've translated. We'll be putting both of these stories up on the Writers' Centre website, so anyone listening to this podcast will be able to read those stories. I'd like to start with the story you wrote, The Court Martial. Could you tell us about this story and your inspiration for it?
As I come from a former political prisoner background, I met many army personnel in prisons, and it was somehow, you know, it's I really wanted to know how their life, how they get trained, and you know, normal human being to like very obedient robot or something like a killing machines. So from the meetings I met with them, I got I somehow understood how they becomes to get that stage, and then it's a based on those experience, their experiences, and I put into the as a short story forms.
Yeah, it's a very striking short story because you're writing from the perspective of one of the soldiers, one of the members of the military.
Yes.
And about his change of heart.
Yes, also they are here, you know, what I found is that they are also human beings. They have a lot of inner struggles between to obey the order, specifically to obey the injustice order and to follow their human instincts. I met those army personnels I met in prison, sir, when they were sick or when they are in very weak situations, sir, they got nightmare. Some share to me or how those nightmares are still were haunting even in prison, sir. Most related to their killing innocent people in their battlefields or in their operations.
Yeah, you yourself spent 19 years as a political prisoner. How has this affected your writing and the subjects that you choose? Are you drawing on that experience in all your stories? What is your...
Yes, prison was a kind for me. It's a university, so everything's now I'm doing is what I got from in prisons. Now I'm reproducing. And also whatever you know, I'm going to write down. It's somehow related to my prison life.
You also, we were talking earlier and you mentioned your photography project as well.
Yes.
Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I also, actually in prison, why I got in prison, I took part in the democratic movement against the military regime. So in the very beginnings, they use very forceful to suppress our movement, to stop the wave. And also in the beginnings, we were, at the time we were young, 16 years old, we were, we look for weapons to fight against them. And then I did actually, I'm working for the All Burma Student Democratic Front. It's a kind of a student group to use the armed struggle ways against the military regime. And then, however, they are very conventional, well-trained army. We were just umbrella associations, just with broken weapons and small groups of students, young students. In short, however, we failed. And then I got imprisoned. And then in prisons, I'm there trying to revise. I had a lot of time to reconsider about my life. And then one day I got a small piece of paper from old, I don't remember from Newsweek or Times. There was an obituary, one German student leader. He got also the imprisonment when he was young, and he wrote a sentence. It really inspired me. He wrote, the only weapon we have is our mind. So it's really inspired me. That time that we were always looking for the weapons. Mm. The most powerful weapon is our mind. And then since then, I try to tame myself. I'm trying to learn, I'm trying to study whatever it is. And then when I got outside, I try to use whatever I get as a tools, as a medium. Yeah. Photography is one of my tools to continue our struggle for our cause. So there's it's a complicated process. So for during the from 1988 to 2012, there were a lot of friends, colleagues, students, ordinary people, dying in prison, in custody, in investigation camps. Officially, officially means we have one organization's assistance, associations of assistance political prisoners, that kinds of organizations. According to them, there's about 2000s, but nobody knows what the figure actual figure were. So in our process, one thing is missing, sir, is to acknowledge those both sides, the victims and perpetrators. This process we don't have in our transition process. So during my stay in prison, we lost many friends in prison when we got outside. I'm trying to think what I want to do, to do something for them. Then I choose to acknowledge their families, And then there were one, a couple from the Holland. They were film directors, and also they want to do some kind of a photography project called Framing the Transitions. I took part in their project, and they taught me. They brought one portrait photographer, Dana Lexenbach, her name is, and then she taught us how to take a photo. Photograph, how to, for especially for me, how to take a portrait photograph, yeah, how to interpret the feelings of you know, the subject into photography. Then I went around the country and took family portraits of those who died in prisons, custodies, investigation camps. In the portrait, the family members, they hold the photos of their loved one who died in prisons. And there's for 15, about the, yes, 15 or 16 I have collected. And then my next step is after 2 or 3 years, maybe next year, I will visit them again, and some family members I had already passed away because they are very old, and I will take photograph again, the same people, but and the same photos or the same settings, if I can get here, and we can see. In this way, I try to console them and try to share their trauma, their sufferings.
You said that, you know, we'll see the photo of the loved one that they're holding.
Yes.
That person will stay the same age as they get older.
Yes, yes, older. The family members
are
become older and older, but in the their loved one is still the same age in the photograph.
Yeah.
And somehow he's still living.
So. Yeah, it's a very moving idea.
Yes.
Just returning to the anthology, in your introduction, Lucas, you talk about the impact on writers of censorship in Myanmar. And you say that many of the stories, including Leah's story, The Court Martial, would have been unlikely to pass the censorship board only a few years ago. Is there still censorship in Myanmar, or has that changed now?
People are still somehow in their old habits, self-censorship.
Article 66D is still a problem of the telecommunications law. Even though that's still, it's technically applying to Facebook posts or blog posts. But technically anything that you write and put online, somebody can accuse you of defaming them. They go to the local police station, they bring a case against you. The police have no choice but to arrest you. Even if you don't end up going to prison, you're going to be held in custody for a very long time. And even if you're eventually found innocent, whoever's accused you doesn't have to pay costs. So it's not a benign law at all. It's very insidious. And it has, I think there was a case last year of a writer in Tanathari division who wrote a short story about a fish in a polluted river. And yes, one of the local mining companies thought that he was writing about their mine. So the mining company actioned a case against him and the newspaper or journal which he was published in. Then there was another case of, again, maybe last year, there was high school students who did a play. And I think they were taken under Article 660 of the telecommunications law because it was posted online. So self-censorship is still definitely an issue, but I think writers also have to be careful what they put online. Mm. I think you're seeing a lot of the media getting, and a lot of Facebook users getting prosecuted on this, not so much for the writers, because they're mostly still in print. Not many of these writers have blogs. Mm. If and when blogs do become popular, I think they're going to have to be very careful.
It's ironic. 3 months ago, one local weekly journal published a satire about the military taking part in peace process, how the military is doing with, and also the military produced a film there. So the writers write a satire story about the film. It's okay on print, but when they put it on the on their Facebook, and they got arrested through the telecommunication law.
But the guy who actually wrote it, he spent 2 or 3 weeks in jail, or maybe longer, but then he was granted bail and eventually released, because he wasn't the one who physically put it on the internet. So it was whoever's in charge of the online content for that journal was the one who got sentenced. But he still spent however many weeks in prison waiting for someone to realize that.
The one, the chief editor who posts on the Facebook is still under trial.
Still under trial. And how many? Months ago, right? Months
yes,
ago.
Yes, yes.
And have you mentioned self-censorship as well. Has this been a problem for you, or do you feel that you can write about whatever you want to write about? Do you allow yourself to write about it?
Yes, I still have the problem, sir, especially in my mother language. Somewhat, I have to, when I'm going to write down, there's an alarm. So and just stop and think and this I must do. I need to cultivate myself the courage. I have to decide. Okay, I will write down these things. Whatever it can be, exposed to father problems. But I will face, and then I decide in that way, and I have to write down in that way. And somehow, when I write in English, it's easy for me. It's somehow distancing myself. It's a little bit easier than in my mother language.
Mm. So you're freer in English.
Yes.
Yeah. You're a translator, you translate into English, and you translated the court-martial yourself from Burmese into English.
Yes.
What was it like translating your own work? Are the two stories the same in the different languages, or did you make changes?
Oh, yes, it's a very, when we plan to translate the short stories, my one is also for me. I'm in confusion. I don't want to give these stories to others to translate into English because I'm afraid. There's no. They cannot carry the real taste, real feelings to the in English, and also when I translate myself, it seems like an endless process. other ones, I can easily do it, translate into English, but for myself, my own stories, it's like I am doing the a kind of a self or drafting again.
Can I just interrupt there? You're exactly right, because when obviously I helped drafting the versions with you, with the other translators, it also with Silent Sun the same as you, but with the other translators you would give suggestions and give help and they'd be okay, but you were adding to the story as you were drafting, so you were adding bits that weren't in the original Burmese, because you were having another chance to write it, as you say, in a language that you feel more comfortable perhaps in,
yes.
in being more honest and more true. So I think that created a very long process with your story, because I felt that you never really felt like it was completed.
I guess you're also writing for a different audience when you're translating it into the English.
Yeah, yes. And being fully aware of that as well.
Yeah. You also translated us the story from Rakhine, The Poisoned Future. Could you tell us about the writer and about this story? Who was the original writer? And then there was another translator who translated into Burmese.
Into Burmese, yeah. He was a school teacher from Rakhine State, yeah.
His name is
Green Ma.
Mm-hmm.
His band name is We Have Band Name.
Mm.
Green Ma.
Right.
He is a very independent person. So, in this story, I notice here, expose their his people's. Everything's a weakness, even their weakness he exposed in the stories. Mm-hmm. And then for translating his story, I had to go visit him and working with him 2 days. And he showed me the places he used as a settings in the mm-hmm. stories, and also he showed me how they do the funeral process, how mm-hmm. to bury the funeral, and also there's I don't understand some what's the use they have a special names for the funeral things. So he showed me everything. Sir. And then I got a visualization. Sir.
Mm-hmm.
Then I translate from Burmese to English. So it's somehow I feel the words are tangible for me, become tangible for me and concrete.
Yeah, the story itself is very visual.
Yes.
You can really imagine yourself by that river.
Yes.
So it was interesting to hear that you had actually been taken to those places.
Yes.
Yeah. We all met a couple of years ago at the first Link the World's Literary Translation workshop in Yangon that you mentioned earlier. At the end of the workshop, it was very moving to hear one of the senior translators praising the workshop as the first major translation event in Myanmar since 1969. It certainly felt like a very kind of momentous occasion. I'd like to ask you both now, how do you feel about the future for writing and translation in Myanmar?
I'll say that. I'll take it from the ethnic literature point of view. Ethnic literature is obviously going to suffer because of the severe lack of translators. The pool of native English speakers from Kayar or Kayor or Ta'ang or Shanji, Rawang. I mean, Matu. The list is over 100. In that respect, I think it's going to be very difficult for ethnic literature to really go beyond the borders of Myanmar. But it can be done. I came across a wonderful novel. A couple of years ago, it's it has to be the first novel that's ever been translated into English from the ethnic languages, and probably the first novel written in an ethnic language. It was written by Joel Ling, an ethnic Chin. He originally wrote it in Lai Hakka, He published it in Lifehacker, not Burmese, and he managed to sell 3,000 copies, which by any stretch of a literary fiction, 3,000 copies is great. But he managed to do that in a language that's probably spoken by less than 500,000 people in the least developed state in the second least developed country in Asia, in a state with no roads, with no bookshops, with barely any electricity. So it's not just, the people are willing, they want to read it. The translator, Richard Zatu, is also ethnic Chin, and he reads and writes Lifehacker, and the translation is fantastic. It really is one of the finest translations I've seen of any fiction piece coming from Myanmar. The problem that Joel Ling has, and the problem that all ethnic writers are going to have, is access to the international market. It's even getting publishers interested in Yangon can be challenging. Getting them interested in other areas and in other languages is going to be even more challenging for them. So I think it also, there's success in the future of ethnic language literature depends on the risks that an international publishers, especially those in the West, will take.
Hopefully this anthology will kind of give them an insight into the kind of stories that they're missing.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of our key sort of hopes of the book was to just to get the voices from these writers outside of Myanmar and into the hands of people in the West who care and who want to read more.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, from English to Burmese translations, we are that kinds of things are coming back here. Becoming stronger and stronger. In the past, we had a very strong traditions translating the English classics into Burmese. It's in their old generations. They had good educations, so they could translate English books into Burmese. Also, but quite rare, from Burmese to English. Though they in their time, I mean about the 90 or after, post war periods from 1990s, 1960s. They also they were able to write in English, but after 1962, our country were under military regime, the so-called revolutionary councils led by General Nguyen. So since that time, our educations, literature, arts, cultures are under one command, under the military regimes. It declines. And then when the country opened up in 2012, as I said before, from English to Burmese, that kinds of traditions coming back, are developing, still developing, but not very much. Not very wider, but from Burmese to English is still very difficult for us. Also, there are some books translated into English, but we don't have a skill translator. We did not have an English editor. To get a market is still mysterious for us. However, you British Council and you did a translation workshops, the ones Link the Wall, led by Alfred Bumbum.
Yes.
It was a very amazing. We got a chance to study hands-on experience from Alfred. He directed operations. He asked us, you translate. He divided our 10 peoples into five groups and assigns chapter by chapter. Then we translate from Burmese to English. Then he put on the screen and he start editing by thinking a lot. He's editing the one sentence and he's thinking himself, but he speak out how this word should be. He's actually at the time we were confused. He was talking to us or he was talking to himself or he was talking to whom we did not know. But actually, this is he show how his inner process was working between these two languages. It's a very direct kind of direct injections to us. Sorry, I'm a little bit out of your question, sir.
That's fine.
We need that kinds of trainings. Basically, we have some competent translator from Burmese to English, but we need an editor and we need to know how those editor works in their minds.
Yeah, there's a lot of potential for us to carry on working together, and I hope we will be able to bring more voices from Myanmar to the English language audience.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Thank you both very much for this conversation.
Thank you.
As I said, the two stories we've talked about will be available on the Writers' Centre website, and we'll also put their details for how people can get hold of the Hidden Words, Hidden Worlds anthology.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. It really helps us when people like the podcast, subscribe, or leave positive reviews on iTunes, so please do that if you enjoyed this. You can also check us out on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram, or find us at writerscentrenorwich.org.uk. Over on the website, you can find out more about the noisy building work here at Dragon Hall and our ongoing transformation into the National Centre for Writing.